WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In his new memoir, Tom Hayden writes, "My father's generation believed correctly that they had defended democracy against foreign despotism. We believed we were defending democracy from its enemies at home." That belief motivated Tom Hayden's actions throughout the 60s when he was at the forefront of the New Left. In 1962, he wrote the Port Huron Statement, which set the agenda and the tone for the New Left. He was an organizer of the student movement and the founding field secretary of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. He was active in the Southern Civil Rights Movement and worked as a community organizer in Newark at the time of the Newark riots. In 1967, the FBI put him on its rabble-rouser index. In 1968, he was one of eight people indicted for conspiring to riot in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. But by the end of the 60s, Hayden felt alienated from the direction the movement had taken. In the 70s, he met and married Jane Fonda and began his career in electoral politics. He's now serving his third term as a California State Assemblyman. His new autobiography is titled Reunion. Welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm glad to be here in Fresh Air.
I want to start by asking you to read just the opening sentence from the introduction to the Port Huron Statement, which you wrote.
This was written in the spring of 1962. "We are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably at the world we inherit."
You really acknowledge in the opening to this statement that, for the most part, you're middle class and educated.
Right. It's not exactly the Communist Manifesto. This is definitely a generational appeal, and it probably continues to be my outlook that I'm influenced by being part of a generation, the 60s generation.
Did you feel at the time you wrote that you were breaking from the past and being this group of leftists who were young, who were middle class, and who were educated? Or did you feel that was part of some tradition of the left?
It depends who you talk to. I think that for me it was a break. I was never even completely sold on left, as in new left. I was more new. I think there were some who came together out of the left-wing traditions of the immigrants to New York, and whose children found their way to the Ann Arbors and the Madisons and the Berkeleys and so on, who felt that they were a link in a left-wing tradition that was very much passed down from generation to generation. I identified intellectually with what I knew of that tradition, but I came out of the sort of non-tradition of the assimilated middle class. I was the first person to go to the university in my family and so on. And I was more new and others were more left, but we all shared a belief that, a utopian belief, that we could and would and were entitled to change the world.
Further into the introduction that you wrote in the Port Huron Statement, you said that work should involve incentives worthier than survival. Now, in a way, you could say that that's the beginning of the cultural ethic of the 60s, that there's more to life than struggle, that there's a certain amount of fun and of rewards that one should get out of life.
I think that's correct. It also is generational in the sense that it's a hope that we can step forward from what our grandparents and parents had gone through when work was very much about survival and survival only.
In a way, that kind of set the tone for the cultural radicalism of the 60s, which you ended up feeling, I think, very alienated from, the cultural radical part.
Well, I was perhaps alienated from it. I'm not sure that this sets in motion the counterculture.
No.
I think that what you have here are glimmers of a generation feeling radically uprooted from its past and launching itself on a mission through civil rights work in the South, but the larger mission of somehow remaking the world that we had inherited. Some people took that into experimentation with lifestyle. Others went a more political route, and you had these two pathways through the 60s. I was the more political, but I must say that on generational grounds, I defended and supported the lifestyle revolution. But my secret was that I was relatively straight in the context of those times and the terminology of those times.
Yeah, you say in your book that you were as unlikely to become a hippie in the 60s as you were to become a beatnik in the 50s. What made you unlikely to become that? What was not right for your nature?
Well, I was attracted to the beats and to the subterranean culture of the 50s, but I wanted to be a journalist. I guess part of me has always been pragmatic and practical and attempting to achieve concrete things in the terminology of the time, more linear and more political.
It's interesting, in the Chicago conspiracy trial, you were in the position of being in the middle of this media circus, in a way, where both the political left and the cultural left were sharing center stage. And you, I think, were very uncomfortable by a lot of what was happening there. You wanted to have a much more straight, rational defense that was offered. What were you able to do to make that clear?
Well, I hated the trial, frankly. Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman described it as the Academy Award of protest, and they were excited. They thought that it was a great opportunity for drama, and others thought it was a great opportunity for a political defense of the 60s and a counterattack on the Nixon administration and so forth. I had just been trying to leave the national scene. I had felt quite alienated from it and wanted to live in Berkeley, and I had a relationship. And I had also become quite skeptical of being able to pressure the government into anything. I mean, to me, I didn't know how to move forward. People around me were advocating going underground. It was already at that point. And here was this trial where my lawyers, bless their souls, advised me that we would probably go to jail for 7 years. And I saw that as not only disruptive, but in the paranoia that was starting to envelop me, I thought, well, 7 years is one thing, but how do we know we're going to get out? Because there's liable to be disturbances in the prison. You have to go back and remember that there were riots in prisons. At Attica, people were shot and killed by the shot by the scores. And so I had a very gloomy perspective on this. So I came to the trial not wanting to be on trial at all, not thinking that it was a great opportunity, but clinging to a belief that was ebbing, but I was clinging to it, that we had to convince the jury of our innocence, or failing that, set a record that the higher courts would overturn the case. And the key in my mind was finding some of those members of the jury to understand that if they agreed with us, they could hang the jury. That is, they could say we were not guilty and sit there till hell froze over. And so I kind of busied myself with the defense and became an additional lawyer and tried to construct a complicated rationale for everything that had happened in Chicago and negotiate between the anti-war and the yippies, and I think we put on 105 witnesses. It was quite a defense. If you want to look at an archive of the times, the edited transcripts of the Chicago trial are quite interesting.
Well, you know, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Tom Hayden, who is now serving in the California State Legislature, and he's written a memoir about his life and he writes a lot about the 1960s when he was at the forefront of the New Left. In your memoir, you wrote that jail in the civil rights movement was a necessary moral act and a rite of passage into serious commitment. But by the time of the Chicago conspiracy trial, had you already had it with jail? Was it a rite of passage you'd already been through?
You know, I put that in because somebody reading it said, well, you're trying to write for people who were a new generation of readers, and you have to explain that going to jail was seen as what today I guess they would call a career move. It was important. You know, if you hadn't gone to jail, you weren't really with the program. And it didn't matter if you were going to be beaten or clubbed. Jail in the South was the place to be if you were a serious person. And your question is an interesting one. By the end of the 60s, had I had it with jail? No, but I had... in the South, if you were in jail, you could appeal to the outside world and believe that there was an America that would hear your cry. If by the end of the 60s you went to jail... it was at the hands of the U.S. government, not the local sheriff, and it was less clear whether there was anybody listening to your appeal. It was much more of a permanent lockup, and whether you got out or not, it was, in fact, an exile. It was going into exile in your own country. And the difference between the two periods, the early and the late 60s, was just that margin of idealistic hope that marked the early years, and the margin of despair and hopelessness that marked the end of the decade.
By the time of the Chicago conspiracy trial, some of the people who you knew well were going underground in order to escape prison sentences or in order to do very radical, sometimes violent work without being able to be tracked down by the authorities. Did you ever consider going underground yourself?
Yes, I thought that it was a plausible alternative. And I went back and forth. I mean, part of me has always been an activist, and part of me has always been kind of an observer or an analyst. And I thought it was quite possible that we were entering into a period of mass arrests, persecution, much worse than the McCarthy period, and that we had a stone-cold government, and that going underground, whether it was the nonviolent kind of escape of the Berrigans or the people setting up escape routes for draft resistors to Canada and Sweden, or people who were helping fugitives, or people who were even planning some kind of acts of violence against property, there was something plausible about their case. It was not that unbelievable. And I think a listener today might find it unbelievable. So it's all context. The other side of me thought that it was based too much on a premise of paranoia, that while some of these things were happening, that this was still a country whose institutions could be moved by organizing and speaking and educating and pressuring, and maybe sometimes the pressure would have to be very forceful or very disruptive, but there was a side of me that believed that it could be done, and that going underground was writing the country off, was writing the institutions off prematurely and totally. That was the but then there was also an ego part of it. The going through the notion of disappearing into a world where you would be an exile in your own country, gone, and not being able to write and organize and not being able to live a normal life was also part of the strife that I felt within myself.
So those are some of the reasons why you decided not to go underground. Well, at this time, too, in the late 60s, I think that... the leaders of SDS had really parted with the philosophy behind the SDS as it existed when you co-founded it. And in a way, it was probably an interesting position to be in. In the early 60s, you parted ways with what has since been called the old left and started a more a more leftist-oriented philosophy suited to your generation, a younger generation. Then by the late 60s, there's a generation of student radicals basically overturning the vision that you and your fellow SDS founder shared of participatory democracy. How did it feel when there were student leaders who were becoming more radical and more supportive of violent actions? Knowing that to them you had become outdated in a way.
Well, I was not. That was not the dividing line for me. I think the dividing line for me was where it became more obscure ideology. And how did it feel? It was like a Dostoevsky novel. All of these characters have appeared. If you read *The Possessed* by Dostoevsky, or if you read *Man's Fate* by Andre Malraux, what you find is that, unlike our belief at the beginning of the '60s that we were really new, and that we were going to change the world in a different way, we were characters that had been seen before in history. The early utopians, the early visionaries. Who said things will be different, and then, in short order, we turned into, or our followers turned into caricatures of all the things that that we had been warned against. In other words, by the end of the decade, somebody said to me, "Well, we offed the pig," and I didn't know what they were talking about. And they said they closed the SDS office. I mean, in other words. The early SDS had become the enemy of the later SDS, and some of the people, and I had great affection for them and closeness to them, and was attracted to their determination. But they were engaged in everything that we said would never happen to us. Arguments over the Russian Revolution. The Chinese Revolution. One guy was given a present as a joke by his friends. It was the writings of the Communist Party leader of Albania in Albanian, and he was touched by it. He thought that it was an actual sincere gift. He was so into the Albanian way, and he's still out there.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break here. My guest is Tom Hayden, and he was at the forefront of the New Left in the 1960s, a founder of SDS and a defendant in the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. He's now a California state legislator and has just written an autobiography titled Reunion. We're going to talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Hayden is my guest. There were times in the 60s when you were denounced by people who you worked with as being too chauvinistic or too egotistical, too much in the spotlight. And I was wondering how you would react to that, like what you would like take to heart and really introspect about, and what would just make you really furious.
Well, my first reaction was defensiveness. I went to the other extreme of trying to incorporate myself into small groups and make myself more faceless. That was sort of silly. My final conclusion from it was that it's almost impossible to make any kind of social change without the people involved showing a lot of competitiveness and ego rivalry and tension to a point where the pressure becomes very painful, and it's almost as if in believing in grassroots democracy, some people want to do away with any differences in talent or in leadership or in speaking ability or what have you, so that all distinctions between leaders and led disappear. And I certainly advocated that myself until I became a leader. And there's a lot to it, because people have to have incentives to join movements, and not everybody can be a leader by definition, so you have to have other incentives than power and glory and all that. But at the same time, there's something in all of us that I now understand that wants things to be personalized and wants leaders to be identified so that we can at worst look up to somebody as above us, or at best be able to make a better judgment about what's being said. If somebody wants to sell me a doctrine or a bill in the legislature, I look carefully at who's proposing it and make a judgment partly on the merits, but also on the quality of the person and how much I trust them. Well, and that too is a natural human need.
Well, you're an official leader now. You're
That's
an elected
right.
leader, an elected official. And I'm wondering if it's given you the opportunity to be comfortable about things that you had to be very ambivalent about in the 60s, such as being a leader. Because as a politician, you're supposed to be a leader. That's what they voted you in for. And as a politician, mm-hmm. there's always an expression of ego. You're not supposed to cover it up and pretend, you know, like you,
I'm
like
more
you have none.
I'm more comfortable, but... I must say that I see close up what people in the 60s were frightened about in politics, because there is a difference between ego and egomania, and
uh-huh.
between leadership and pomposity, and I think that the balance is yet to be found.
Were you very afraid to get into politics when you decided to do it? Because let's face it, politics by a lot of people in the New Left was considered the co-optation of
right. It was
the
like
left, if you ran for politics.
It was like from the legacy I carried from the 60s, getting into politics was like releasing my forbidden self.
You
know, it was like it was the taboo is taken off and the monster materializes. And there's a real problem that, because while everybody that you're involved in politics with has none of these, they have none of these questions for the most part, they're going for it, and it is the expansion of their personal power. You are plagued constantly, hourly, by questions of whether you're being too vain or power-driven. And if you're not questioning yourself, then your closest supporters are, because they share your ambivalence. And I think that's the reason that the people of the New Left in the 60s who've gone into many professions have rarely gone into politics, because of a lingering skepticism, which I understand, about the self-promotion that's inherent. When you run for office, you run as Tom Hayden. You don't run as proponent of economic democracy. People vote for the person as well as the party.
Well, I think another thing that could have been seen changing your values in some ways when you met and married your wife Jane Fonda, because she was an actress, she was, you know, glamorous. It was seen, I think, by some people as buying into a materialistic, you know, money oriented, glamorous kind of world that the New Left had rejected. And I was wondering if you took a lot of grief from political friends when you and Jane Fonda started being together.
maybe there was a lot of grief, but I think it was suppressed, because too many of them, if they felt this way, still wanted her to come to their fundraisers. So it's probably in the static, and certainly in the image. I mean, I met a reporter yesterday from the Boston Globe who's 32 years old, who was arguing and questioning. He didn't want me to be happy. he was unhappy that I was happy. He wanted me to be an unhappy warrior on some barricade. And I said, I am what I am. And I think there are other people who are of the 60s, and but also it's inherent in liberalism, who are ambivalent about success. And I think the heart of the matter. We started, people like myself were very success-oriented. I was a student editor, and the other people were student body presidents. We thought we were going to change the world. Then, as our radical questioning of the world deepened, we questioned success. That became the S word, the forbidden word. And the ambivalence remains, and it's almost become... a cultural tradition, I think, on the left, to equate principle with maintaining a marginal or outsider status. Now, by that, I don't mean to put anybody down or to glorify success, but it is my observation that success is a very difficult value for people who are critical of this materialistic society to embrace. It's very tough.
When you started running for office, did you go through a period of feeling like you had to deny your past, that you had to make a break from it in order to be acceptable to the electorate?
I felt besieged within myself from both directions, that on the one hand I had to explain and calm people down about my past, but also I had, because of who I was and who my real core supporters were, I had to be consistent with my past. So I had to balance continually what were demands that were competitive.
Have you thought about what made you a radical in the first place? Like, why you became a radical? I mean, it's hard to point to one thing.
Well, I want to know that, and I've written this book, Reunion, hoping that some critic will discover the real me in the pages, you know, like a person talks to their therapist or something. It's in there, but far be it from me to know. It's not that I'm left-handed. It's not that I was raised in a Catholic church under Father Coughlin. It's not that I'm an only child or whatever. I mean, there are too many psychological explanations. I think that it lies somewhere in the accident of a person like myself and others intersecting with history at a moment that there's a wave that a younger generation chooses to ride. I was an observer. I was an alert, interested, curious. I wanted to be a writer. And along came a moment when it appeared that the whole world could be reshaped, and it was up to students. And something in me could not resist the excitement of that challenge.
Well, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for
being here. My guest has been Tom Hayden, and his new autobiography is titled Reunion. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.